Case number 13-7114, Board of County Commissioners of Kay County, Oklahoma, Appellant versus Federal Housing Finance Agency as Conservator for Federal National Mortgage Association and Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation et al. Mr. Burns for the appellant, Mr. Johnson for the appellees.
Mr. Burns, good morning. Before you start, let me just advise everyone we're trying to do something about the air conditioning. It was off over the weekend, and it is warm in here, but hopefully it'll get cooler. Go ahead.
Morning, Your Honor. My name's Warren Burns. I'm with the law firm of Sussman Godfrey down in Dallas, Texas, so this is somewhat cool by Texas standards. I represent the appellant in this case, the Board of County Commissioners of Kay County, Oklahoma. Your Honors, this is an important case. I think that's apparent by the attention that both parties have given it, as well as the United States, which has intervened on this appeal. It is important because it tests the bounds of Congress's ability to exempt private for-profit entities from non-discriminatory state taxes in an area touching on the transfer of real property. Finally, it's important to my client, Kay County, and counties across the state of Oklahoma, because the revenue derived from Oklahoma's documentary stamp tax is used to fund the general operations, used to pay for projects at home. Now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac say they don't have to pay Oklahoma stamp tax, and the government says they're right. My client views this matter differently, and we ask this court to review to reverse the district court's order dismissing the case for at least three reasons that I'll focus on here. First, we ask this court to exercise its discretion and find that Kay County has not waived its constitutional arguments. And I'll get to that first and foremost in a minute.
Well, you may want to get to that first.
Fair enough, Your Honor. I'll cover it.
I don't want to discuss that issue unless it's properly before us. Appellees raised the argument that you didn't argue this in the district court. You have a reply brief that virtually bypasses that problem. You didn't raise this in the district court. Did you?
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. And I'm not gonna sit here and try to run away from that fact. And I'll address that as you asked first. As a threshold matter, the court does have the discretion to hear the arguments today on the constitutional issue.
Knowing that constitutional avoidance is the a guiding star, at least, of appellate jurisprudence, why should we take on a constitutional issue that isn't properly before?
There are a couple reasons, Your Honor. First, bear in mind that these issues, all the issues before the court, were raised on a motion to dismiss. So in the first instance, we were responding to the appellee's arguments raised in their motion, which did not include a constitutional argument at all at the threshold. Now, I'm not going to sit up here and try to...
The constitutional argument would have to come from your side in the first instance.
That is correct.
I mean, they have this presumption of constitutionality. If the Constitution argument can be raised, that's got to be used. I don't understand the relevance.
That is correct, Your Honor, and we did raise, and again, I'm not trying to stretch this beyond the bounds that's in the papers, but we did raise the issue of implied constitutionality at the threshold. We did not raise the statutory exemption argument at the district court. But we would implore this court to exercise its discretion in this case for a couple of very important reasons. First, there's no doubt that you do have discretion to hear this argument where there are issues that are novel, important, and recurring questions. And we submit that the issues in this case pertaining to...
Can I just follow up on
certainly. The
constitutional avoidance question? When you say we have discretion, I know we have discretion to sometimes entertain pure questions of law. Are you aware of a case from this court or the Supreme Court that has said we can entertain a constitutional challenge to a federal law that was not preserved below, that we can overcome principles of waiver in that particular context?
Not in this precise context, Your Honor. But I will make this point. The issue is here
in
before
any
this
context,
court,
other than where it goes to the jurisdiction, either of this court or the body under review, you know, any case in this court other than in that one set aside where we have done so?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, not just in this context, but in any context.
No, Your Honor. But
other than that one.
No, certainly, Your Honor. And again, I don't want to stress your patience here, but I think the principles involved in those cases, where you're dealing with issues of law, where there's no factual record, there's no development of facts, discovery in the district court, you're clearly dealing with arguments that are made solely on the briefs at the dismissal phase, apply as equally in this case. There have been no submissions of facts before the district courts beyond those that were made in the pleadings, which were assumed to be true for purposes of the motion to dismiss. So this is clearly a question of constitutionality and a question of law that, frankly, this panel is in just as good a position as the district court to hear. That said, I wish we had raised the full panoply of issues before the district court, but the simple fact is that we did not. I'll also acknowledge up front, and I'll touch on those constitutionality issues briefly, also acknowledge up front that obviously we have a bit of a hard row to hoe here today. Five of your sister circuits have come out with opinions that have rejected many of the textual arguments, the statutory construction arguments that we have made below as well.
In that regard, can I ask you a question? There are obviously tax exclusion statutory provisions both for Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and then there is a separate one for the FHFA. Since the FHFA is a conservator, is that the only legally operative one that we're looking at, or do we actually look at, even though the FHFA is here as the conservator for both of those entities, do we look behind FHFA's own legislation and to the underlying statutory provisions for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae?
It's our position that you would, Your Honor. The challenge
that we would look at all three of those provisions?
In the sense, yes, in the sense that the challenge activity before this court precedes the FHFA takeover of the, or stepping in as the receiver of the two.
But any remedial order from a court would operate only on FHFA directly, is that correct at this point?
I think that's right, Your Honor. It steps into the rights and obligations of the two GSEs and would bear that responsibility.
Do you see any material difference between the wording of those three provisions, or do you think the coverage is the same for all three?
We don't. We think they're substantially similar, Your Honor.
Substantially or similar? Identical?
I wouldn't say identical because the words, there are
right. The whole point of statutory construction is when words differ, sometimes meanings differ. So I'm asking whether any of the word differences have any material difference to you.
No material difference, Your Honor, in terms of the express exemptions and the exclusions that apply. I see my time will be running short, so I just do want to touch on one piece of the constitutional argument, if you will, and that relates solely to the substantial effect at this point. This tax is barely over 0.1%. It's non-discriminatory. It's non-recurring. In effect, it's very much like the property tax, which is clearly excluded under the statutory exemptions present in this case. There were no findings by Congress. No one has pointed. The appellees have not pointed to anything in the legislative history that would indicate that Congress specifically addressed this issue, nor on a rational basis inquiry would it make sense for Congress to reach into this behavior.
Your legal theory would be the same even if the tax were a much higher tax, correct?
The legal theory would be the same.
So it doesn't really matter whether this is small or big?
It does not, but the distinction here, Your Honor, is that the appellees have made the argument that Congress was trying to shield Fannie and Freddie from excessive state taxation that varied across states. In reality, they're already subject to that because there's the express exception in their charters to property taxes, which vary by state and which are, frankly, as common sense would dictate, higher than the documentary tax at issue here. With that, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
All right. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the Court. District Court correctly dismissed plaintiff's claims, applying reasoning that's been adopted by dozens of other courts, including unanimous decisions of five courts of appeals, 3rd, 4th, 6th, 7th, and 8th. The only court ever to adopt any of plaintiff's arguments was promptly reversed on an interlocutory appeal in the Sixth Circuit. Plaintiff's arguments all lack merit, and this court should affirm. Let me begin with the issue of forfeiture. Plaintiffs' constitutional arguments are not properly before this court. They admit they didn't raise them in the district court. Mr. Burns said it this morning. It's clear from their brief. This circuit's precedents require that this be an exceptional case with a compelling reason why a party didn't raise the issue they forfeited in the district court. This is not an exceptional case, Your Honors. There are dozens of them pending around the country. They've been looked at by other courts of appeals. There is no possibility that this issue will escape judicial review. There is no compelling reason. There's no reason at all why plaintiffs couldn't have raised these constitutional issues in the district court. They made a choice. They chose not to do it. That choice forfeited those issues before this court. Let me return to the issues that are properly before the court. Those are the issues of statutory construction. Plaintiff's primary argument is that the words all taxation or exempt from all taxation in the three statutes at issue here mean much less than all taxation. Congress enacted a statute using the words all taxation, and somehow that those words mean some taxation, but not all taxation.
Can I ask you a question about statutory construction principles? When Congress enacts a very broadly worded prohibition, like it did in the first half here of these statutory provisions, and then has an exception, are there any rules that you're aware of about whether exceptions to broadly worded, capacious provisions should be construed narrowly, particularly narrowly given the breadth of the preceding wording, or do we just give it its ordinary force?
Well, there are three principles at issue, but to sort of jump ahead to the answer, I think we give the provisions their ordinary meaning in English. Three reasons why. First, there is a principle of statutory construction that the plaintiffs cite in the brief. They cite it quite frequently, and that's that exemptions from taxation are construed narrowly in favor of the state against the taxpayer. We understand that. However, there's also the provision that really governs in this case that when looking at federalism principles, Congress needs to express its intention clearly and manifestly when limiting state power to tax and its other fundamental powers. Congress did that here. The exemption uses language that's really not susceptible of any but its ordinary meaning. The entities, each of them, shall be exempt from all taxation now or hereafter imposed by a state, locality, or municipality. It's not.
Well, it doesn't say except for real estate property taxes. It says to the same extent as other real property is taxed. And so I guess my question is, you know, do we look at that as a code language for real estate taxes, or does it actually suggest by its nature something a bit broader, that as long as it's being taxed and treated the same way real property is treated in other contexts, such as a transfer tax, that would be okay? What's your answer to that?
The language in the statutes is actually that each entity's real property may be subject to tax. So the question this court must answer is this tax a tax to which real property is subject? The answer to that question is no.
To the same extent as other real property is taxed.
Real property is taxed. Mm-hmm. So what is taxed? Is it the owner of the real property? Is it the activity of transferring the real property? Is it the property transaction? No. It's the property itself that must be taxed or must be subject to tax for the exception.
I'm just trying to figure out why they didn't just say except for real estate taxes and instead use some different wording that's to the same extent as other real property is taxed.
Well, that's the key, with great respect to Your Honor, I think the key phrase is subject to tax, except that the entity's real property shall be subject to tax. That's the operative phrase, and then there's a qualifier, to the same extent that other real property is taxed. My understanding of what Congress meant with that latter part is you can't have a special property tax for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They can't be subject to a higher rate. The key operative phrase is except that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's real property can be subject to taxation. Now, how do we know that a documentary stamp tax, a transfer tax, isn't a tax to which real property is subject? I'd give you at least three reasons. First, we can look at the Oklahoma statutory structure. Oklahoma has a separate chapter on taxes to which property is, quote, subject. That's the word the Oklahoma legislature used when it enacted the property tax statute. That's not the language it used when it enacted the documentary stamp tax. The documentary stamp tax is not an immediate encumbrance on the real property.
Can you get to your position without dealing with the specific wording of the Oklahoma tax?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think it would be highly unlikely that we would make a different decision here with respect to Oklahoma than would apply to Texas.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has spoken to the issue in the case the plaintiffs cite on the all taxation part of the statute. In the Wells Fargo case, the Supreme Court explained the difference between an excise tax, which is a tax levied on a use or transfer of property, and said there's a well-recognized distinction between those kind of taxes, which are not on property, and a tax levied on the property itself. The plaintiffs recognize the distinction. They quote that sentence from the opinion, but then they ignore it. They say the distinction doesn't matter, that the fact that excise taxes are levied on use or transfer, whereas direct taxes are levied on the property itself, somehow means both kinds of taxes are levied on the property itself. Well, that's not what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court said they're different. There's a well-recognized distinction between them. And every court of appeals who have looked at the issue, that's the 3rd, 4th, 6th, and 7th, they all agree. The 4th Circuit said that every common and legal understanding distinguishes between taxes on property and excise taxes like the tax at issue here. There's just no question that this is an excise tax. It's not just Wells Fargo, though, in the Supreme Court jurisprudence. The Pittman case involved an exemption with a similar carve-out or taxation of real property. And the tax at issue there was a tax on a mortgage. A mortgage is an interest in real property. So if the carve-out for real property allowed for taxes on any interest in real property, the tax in Pittman would have been allowed. The Supreme Court said no. The exemption applies. This tax
is the language in Pittman the same as the language here?
It's virtually identical. There are differences in wording, but the operative provision of the exemption was the same. It's an exemption of an entity with a list of enumerated.
What are the words? It's a short phrase. What are the words in the Pittman statute?
The Pittman statute was an entity. It was federal land banks shall be exempt from taxation imposed by a state, county, or municipality. So there's no question here. Taxation and all taxation are coextensive. You can't have something included in all taxation that's not included in taxation and vice versa. Each had a carve-out allowing for taxation.
What was the carve-out in Pittman? You don't seem to want to tell me what the words were on that one, and I don't happen to have brought your brief with me, so
thank
tell
you.
Me what the word
thank
was.
You. Allowed for taxation of the entity's real property. I don't have the wording in front of me either. I'll give it to you.
It shall be subject to taxation to the same extent according to its value as other real property is taxed.
Again, subject real property shall be subject to taxation. This is not a tax on real property. I would also point the court to the United States versus City of Detroit decision. That's a decision where it involved exempt property, property owned by the federal government. The state of Michigan wanted to get some tax revenue from that property. The property was leased to an ordinary industrial corporation, the Borg Warner Corporation. Michigan enacted a statute that taxed any corporation's use of exempt property. So the tax, not on the property, on the use of the property, designed it to raise the same amount of revenue that the property tax would have raised. The Supreme Court held the exemption did not apply. The government's exemption did not apply because a tax on the use of property is not a tax on the property. If it didn't matter, if plaintiffs were correct that any tax intimately connected with real property was close enough to a property tax that it ought to be considered one, the Detroit case would have come out differently. So we've got the Supreme Court saying three different times there is a difference. Excise taxes are not the same as property taxes. An exemption from one does not cover the other. A carve-out for one similarly does not cover the other.
Can I just ask one quick question on the where you started on the constitutional questions? Are you aware of any case from this court which has held that we, in applying waiver principles, they are reinforced or more rigorous when the question at issue is one of constitutional interpretation?
I'm not aware of a decision, but it would be a sensible doctrine to have based on the constitutional avoidance issue that was discussed some with Mr. Burns.
Does Mr. Burns have any time left? Okay.
Just briefly, Your Honors. My colleague began by saying this is not an exceptional case with respect to the waiver point. And I would just stress that it truly is. None of the five of your five sister circuits have addressed the constitutional arguments in the breadth that they have been presented to this court here. They simply have not. And that is the key question that needs to be addressed from our perspective. And absent this court rendering a decision on that point, it can only lead to additional and protracted litigation as we see it. At the end of the day, the Oklahoma state tax at issue here, the stamp tax, amounts to $150 on $100,000 of property value. There's been no showing that there's been a substantial impact on interstate commerce that would justify Fannie and Freddie's reading of the statute in this case. We ask you to reverse the district court. Thank you.